This is a MP3 file from audiomp3books.com. This audio file is form a PDF file entitled Bob Dylan's Real Link to the Rolling Stones, which can be found at mileswmathis.com. Listen to find out how Bob Dylan and the Rolling Stones were projects by the trillionaire financiers whose goal was to accelerate social change in a direction they determined would maximize their wealth. Miles Mathis, Bob Dylan's Real Link to the Rolling Stones. Addendum February 11, 2019, in the research for my later Titanic paper, I tripped across billionaire Eugene Zimmerman of Cincinnati, railroad tycoon who was on the board of Standard Oil. His daughter Helene became the Duchess of Manchester, Montague, and Zimmerman not only arranged the marriage but bought the entire dukedom, including castles and lands. Helena is now called the real Downton Abbey heiress, since the BBC show was based in part on her life. Also remember that in Downton Abbey, Elizabeth McGovern's character is named Cora Levinson. Helena later divorced Montague and married Keith Falconer, Earl of Kintore. This links us to my paper on Ben Franklin, see Governor Keith. Helena's son the 10th Duke married Sidney Verstead, a close relation of British spook William Stead. Eugene Zimmerman also worked with Marconi, alleged inventor of the radio, although we now know it was really Tesla. Given the misdirection we already found concerning Bob Dylan's paternal grandparents, I would say they have scrubbed the link between Dylan and Eugene Zimmerman. For proof of that, see below where we find Bob's father Abe worked for Standard Oil. Coincidence? Not a chance. My guess is that Eugene Zimmerman was a two-great uncle of Bob Dylan, and that Bob's grandfather Zygmunt Zimmerman did not come over from Odessa in 1905. Rather, he came from Cincinnati. Before we move on to the big cities, let's look a little closer at Hibbing. A list of prominent people from Hibbing throws up some real head-scratchers, including Vincent Buell Yossi, Bruce Carlson, Gus Hall, and Chi-Chi LaRue. Gus Hall is the former leader of the U.S. Communist Party. If you want talk know why I see that as a red flag here, consult this recent paper, which exposes Marx himself as a nearly intelligence asset. Bruce Carlson is a four-star general and director of the NRO. The NRO is one of the big five intelligence agencies, along with CIA, DIA, NSA, and NA. Carlson is also one of the heads of the Mormon Church. And of course Vincent Buell Yossi was the attorney who prosecuted Charles Manson, who we now know was just an actor. If you haven't read those linked papers, ya won't get far into this one. Read them, come back to this one, and you will feel differently than you do right now. So some strange things appear to be coming out of Hibbing. We find more strange things from the Zimmermans. Bob's father Abe worked for Standard Oil. That is Rockefeller's, of course. You will say, so what, maybe that means he owned a gas station. No, we are told he was management level by 1941. Besides, any link to the Rockefellers is a red flag. I suggest this was the main link to New York City. But let's skip ahead a bit. In Bob's high school yearbook, next to his picture, it says, to join Little Richard. That's curious phrasing. Not to be the next Little Richard, or something like that, but to join Little Richard. To join him in what? Wearing mascara? Being a drag queen? Remember, these phrases aren't chosen by the kids themselves. They are chosen by the yearbook writers, who are usually making a joke. So the choice of Little Richard is both strange and telling. It appears his classmates knew something about Bob we didn't and maybe still don't. But even if we assume Bob wanted to join Little Richard in the ranks of famous musicians as the phrase is usually read, the choice of Little Richard is still strange. As with the Bobby V connection a few months later, it doesn't really make any sense. What did Dylan ever have in common with Little Richard or Bobby V? We can see the connection to Woody Guthrie, which we are sold in 1961. But Little Richard and Bobby V? Come on. In 1959, Bob Dylan was 18 and Bobby V was 15. You should have a raft of questions at this point, like, how does a 15-year-old boy from Fargo, North Dakota, sell a song to a record company, Anthon get a contract with the even larger Liberty Records in that same year. Do you really think the record companies were that desperate for talent? Or do you think maybe V had some connections due to his family? Of course we aren't told what those connections were, although I would bet good money someone in the Velen family Bobby's V's real name had married a Rockefeller or Vanderbilt or something. According to his official bio, V's career started in 1959 when he was chosen to fill in for Buddy Holly, etc. on the day the music died. But that was in Morehead, MN. Why would they choose a 15-year-old boy from Fargo to play in Morehead, across state lines? V was a minor and couldn't even get across state lines legally without someone's help. He couldn't drive himself, and anyone but his parents could be stopped for transporting a minor. Yet we are told V and his band volunteered to fill in, and were accepted. Is that at all believable? Age 15 isn't even high school. That is middle school. This is a middle school band filling in for Buddy Holly, Richie Valens and the Big Bopper. Do you think the ticket holders would stand for that? We are told the gig was Ajikas. Is that believable? Three major stars dead in a cornfield, and the show goes on with a middle school band? Who writes this stuff? Want to hear something else weird? What did these middle school boys supposedly call themselves? The Shadows. Cue Twilight Zone music. Here are V's own words on this, from the liner notes to His 1963 tribute album. I remember Buddy Holly about a week before this, I had just organized a vocal and instrumental group of five guys. Our style was modeled after Buddy's approach and we had been rehearsing with Buddy's hits in mind. When we heard the radio plea for talent, we went in and volunteered. We hadn't even named the group up to that time. Sal gave ourselves a name on the spot, calling ourselves the Shadows. What a lucky coincidence, right? A week before Buddy Holly dies in a plane crash near Fargo, ND, a group of middle school boys in Fargo, ND, start a Buddy Holly band and begin rehearsing his hits. Their lead singer memorizes all his lyrics in just 1 week, and when Holly dies, this 15-year-old fills in for him at the local dance, becoming an overnight sensation. You may buy that, but I don't. This is just a cover story for something underhanded, the least sinister of which is that some rich family uses Buddy Holly tragedy to promote their kids, and the most sinister of which is that they made it happen. That was February of 1959. Before the year is out, Bobby V will have cut his own record, a Buddy Holly copy called Susie Baby, sold it to a company capable of releasing it, and scored a hit with it. In that same year, he will be signed by an even larger record company, and will be touring. In that same year, Bob Dylan will play with the band in Minneapolis under the stage name Elston Gunn. You should not only ask yourself how V scored all that action as a 15-year-old boy in less than a year, but what the connection between Dylan and him was. Dylan was a rich Jewish boy just out of high school. Why was he chosen over all others to play keyboards with V? Liberty Records didn't know. Anyone else in Minneapolis/St. Paul who could play the keyboards? And what is Elston Gunn? Is that supposed to be clever? You should ask yourself this, does the cleverness of that stage name match in any way the cleverness of the person who wrote Shelter from the Storm or Like a Rolling Stone? The greatest folk lyricist in American music history starts out his career as Elston Gunn? That would be like finding out John Keats' first choice as a nom de plume was Olden McGroin. That name doesn't match the later Dylan hagiography, but it does match other things Dylan was doing at the time. He spent a short time at the University of Minnesota, where he pledged Sigma Alpha Mu. Yes, Dylan was frat boy. Surprised? You shouldn't be. It fits his medal acceptance from Obama IN 2012. Dylan was never the rebel you thought he was. Rebels don't pledge fraternities, it pretty much goes without saying. Then we are fed the line about Dylan going to New York to visit his hero Woody Guthrie, who was in the hospital with Huntington's disease. What we are never told is why Guthrie agreed to see him. Dylan was a college dropout nobody. If you are a famous guy in hospital with a serious disease, do you want to see every stranger kid who knocks on the door? Does the hospital even allow it? I doubt it. And why would Ramblin' Jack Elliott befriend Dylan? Elliot was already a famous guy in the folk music scene at the time, and Dylan was a 19-year-old nobody. I don't care how talented you are, it doesn't work that way. High school kids don't just go to New York City and hook up with famous people. It doesn't happen now and it didn't happen then. You have to have some sort of entree. You have to be introduced. In the bios, they always skip over that. You are expected to believe Dylan just met these guys in a coffee shop or something and whipped out his harmonica, blowing them away with his soul. Again, it doesn't work that way. They make you think these older guys are just sitting around stoops looking for new young talent. They aren't. Older guys are normally trying to snuff young talent, since it is the young talent that will displace them. That is how the world really works. If Elliot was really promoting Dylan, it is because he was being paid to promote him. It appears Dylan had already been chosen as the front for a big enterprise at that time, and people like Elliot were simply used as cogs in that enterprise to give it ballast and legitimacy. Elliot is also Jewish, the son of a wealthy New York surgeon, so it is not hard to find the first connection. We see the same connection to Allen Ginsberg, who was also from a wealthy Jewish family. These people were connected in ways we aren't told, and it isn't just a Jewish connection. If you want to know why I think Ginsberg is a red flag, you have to read this recent paper on the Beat Generation where I show it was also manufactured by U.S. intelligence. So just seeing Dylan hobnobbing with Ginsberg was enough to give me the clue. Ginsberg, like most of these people, was a big creep and adoring phony, and no one would be hanging out with him who wasn't seeking promotion by the entertainment mafia, which wasn't just Jewish see, for instance, Joseph Kennedy. We don't know who was really writing Dylan's songs, yet, but I assume it wasn't Ginsberg. Ginsberg couldn't write for sour apples. Ginsberg was in desperate need of ghost poets behind him, but he was stuffed too tight to use them. The songs attributed to Dylan most often aren't that great as poetry, either, but they are top-notch as songs and are way beyond anything Ginsberg ever wrote. I will flesh out that opinion below, where we will look at a few of the songs line by line. We see more red flags early on, when in 1961, at age 20, Dylan scored a review in the New York Times. As with Ezra Pound's meteoric rise in London in 1908, Dylan's meteoric rise in New York in 1961 simply isn't believable. He had been playing in Greenwich Village for only about 6 months, had no original material, hadn't written any of his great early songs yet, and somehow the New York Times does a review of him? He was the opening act for the Greenbrier Boys at Gertie's Folk City. There probably weren't 10 people in the audience. So let's ask the question begged. Who wrote the review? Robert Shelton, who was really Robert Shapiro, from another family of wealthy Jews. Who was booking Gertie's at the time? Charlie Rothschild. Does that name ring a bell? Do you think he might be Jewish also? Wealthy family? Also remember who is behind the New York Times. The Sulzberger family, extremely wealthy Jews who also founded the New York Stock Exchange. Even before the New York Times and all other media were taken over by the CIA in the 1950s, that paper had been controlled by extremely vested interests, to say the least. So clearly, someone had a plan for Dylan. Or, we should say, he was the front man for some operation. We will call it Operation Rolling Stone. We know intelligence was running all sorts of secret operations in the 1960s. Many of them have since been partially declassified, like Operation Mockingbird, Operation Bluebird, Operation Chaos Ultra, and many, many more. But there appears to have been an even larger, more fundamental operation beneath all of them. This was Operation Rolling Stone. It was the promotion of change in all forms. To what end? The promotion of trade. The Jews and Gentiles that would run the 20th century were masters of trade. They were money lenders and money changers and money makers. These families had always been very good at making money, but in the 20th century they discovered a way to accelerate this money making beyond even their own dreams. They discovered that accelerated trade depended directly on accelerated change. The more change of any kind they could introduce into society, the more money they would make. This is simply because change can always be accompanied with new products. New products equals new wealth. More products equals more wealth. Therefore, the fundamental and underlying operation of the 20th century has been change. This was revolutionary in every way, since humans don't really like change. Like cats and all other animals, they prefer things to stay as they are. Living creatures tend to equate change with discomfort. So to promote change was to go against human nature. It wasn't something that would happen on its own. It had to be manufactured and constantly sold. It was revolutionary in another way, since it went against all tradition. Tradition had always taught that change was something to be avoided. All the major religions sought balance and harmony, neither of which could be maintained in times of rapid change. It was revolutionary in a third way, since traditionally trade had been considered dirty. Thoreau was still teaching in the 1840s that trade curses everything it touches. Gentlemen in the early 19th century looked down on trade, as we see from reading Dickens or Austen, or watching Downton Abbey. The English aristocracy mocked American wealth, since it came from trade. So you would think it would be difficult to flip the world 180 degrees, taking us to the present where most believe that trade sanctifies everything it touches. Well, it was difficult. It required hiring millions of people and spending vast amounts of capital over more than a century. But the investment paid off, as we see. Accelerated change has made the billionaires into trillionaires. They are now so rich they have to hide their wealth. The wealthiest families won't even allow their names to appear on the Forbes lists, the totals are so obscene. For instance, the Rockefellers are hundreds of times as wealthy as Bill Gates, but we are told they only have a few billion. The truth is, the Rockefellers had made their first trillion by 1930, in today's dollars. We are told they gave most of it away and are now worth less than then. Don't believe it. But what does this all have to do with Bob Dylan? Dylan was just one player in a vast operation off change. And one of the clues is the Rolling Stone meme. We see it coming up several times, in the inks that don't appear to be related. We see Dylan's famous song, we see the band The Rolling Stones and we see the magazine Rolling Stone. All came out in the 1960s. Why? Have you ever asked that question? Maybe. Has anyone ever explained that to you? I don't think so. To understand it, we have to go back to the maxim that started them all. A Rolling Stone gathers no moss. That is attributed to Publius Syrus, from the 1st century BC. That just means little citizen of Syrus, so the person is anonymous. He is said to have been a slave from Syria, later freed, so he may have been a Jew. However that may be, the maxim was suggestive to those who would control the 20th century because it was the perfect expression of change as the engine of wealth. A Rolling Stone gathers no moss, but it gathers something else green, money. This is what Don McLean meant when he said in American Pie, moss grows fat on a Rolling Stone, but that's not how it used to be. The moss there is money. A Rolling Stone gathers no moss, but it grows fat on money. Robert Heinlein cryptically suggested the same thing as far back as 1952, in his story The Rolling Stones. It is about a family in search of adventure and money. So the Rolling Stone meme was a creation of intelligence. It was likely the title of their biggest and longest running operation. In this way, it linked Dylan, The Rolling Stones, and the magazine. All were fronts for British/US intelligence. Their prime directive was the creation of rapid change. Do you think it is a coincidence that one of Dylan's most famous songs is The Times, They Area Changin'? Yes, they were and are, but who was changing them and why? Let's look more closely at lyrics. Come writers and critics who prophesy with your pen and keep your eyes wide. The chance won't come again and don't speak too soon for the wheel's still in spin and there's no telling who that it's naming curious. Dylan is telling writers and critics not to speak too soon. In other words, to keep quiet. To go with it. This is curious because a lot of the change going on in the 1960s wasn't for the better. These people conspicuously tied themselves to the civil rights movement, which was the positive change happening at the time, but far bigger things were going on which we now can see were negative: the rise of intelligence, the rise of the corporate media, the rise of the police state, the continued rise of the war economy, and the permanent entrenchment of a secret government. And we can now add to that the permanent acceleration of society, which would create both huge sums of new wealth and the complete dissolution of culture. Also curious are the lines, and there's no telling who that it's naming. The songwriter is giving us a bite off a clue there, telling us there are unnamed people behind the spinning wheel. With very little digging, we have seen those names come up already: Rockefeller, Rothschild, Sulzberger, etc. This is also curious. Come senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall, for he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. Senators are being told that they will get hurt if they stand in the way of this change. That's not really a progressive sentiment in a republic or democracy, is it? Congressmen are supposed to be representatives of the people, and these representatives are being threatened here. Why does anyone think this song is progressive? Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand. This is no better. It is fascism posing as progressive politics. If your sons and daughters are no longer your charges, who are they the charges of? That's right, the state. The financiers want control of your kids, because they can then sell them things more easily and directly. That is precisely what has happened. Kids are now raised by the corporate media, to the benefit of no one but the billionaires and trillionaires. The line it is drawn, the curse it is cast, the curse it is cast? What does that mean? How could positive change be a curse? If Dylan is just talking about civil rights here, as is the common interpretation, how is any curse being cast? Ask yourself that. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last. The old order is rapidly fading. What was the old order? The aristocracy. In the 20th century, we have seen the aristocracy replaced by the financiers as the controllers of society. The Jews, who were formerly last, will be first, and the aristocrats will now be last. The old houses will be pulled down and replaced by new mansions. These lines are usually read as biblical references, as in the meek will inherit the earth. But that hasn't happened, has it? No, because that was never the plan. That isn't what these lyrics mean. No one ever gave a damn about the meek. The same can be said of Lennon's song Imagine, which is commonly misread as progressive. It is beautifully arranged and performed, which makes it so seductive, but it isn't progressive at all. Imagine there's no heaven, it's easy if you try, no hell below us, above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today, sounds great on a cursory reading, but if you read it in context of recent history, it becomes far more sinister. As I show in my paper on theosophy, the financiers have been trying to destroy all religions in order to co-opt their tithe. If the religions are gone, you have no one to go to but your government. The government becomes your priest and confessor, your father, brother, sister, and mother, and all your alms go to it. Imagine there's no countries, it isn't hard to do, no thing to kill or die for, and no religion to. Imagine all the people living life in peace, no countries. Does New World Order mean anything to you? Without countries, there are no laws except the laws the financiers impose on you. For them, anything goes. That is precisely what we have seen in the past 50 years, and especially since the 1990s, when NAFTA and GATT gutted all local laws in favor of corporate rapine. Imagine no possessions, I wonder if you can, I can. After they take all your possessions, you are left with none. That's what we've seen in the past decades, as the super rich have sucked the middle and lower classes dry with various grand thefts like LIBOR, quantitative easing, corporate bailouts, and a raft of others. And you don't even possess your privacy anymore, since they are spying on you all the time, with satellites, appliances, street cameras, web snooping, illegal phone tapping, open emails, and so on. The song only appears to be progressive. It is really fascism posing as progressive politics. It is misdirection. Which brings us to the Rolling Stones. If you will recall, one of the Stones' early albums was titled Their Satanic Majesty's Request. That was 1967, and the band members were supposedly facing drug busts and jail time and so on. They were being sold as the worst of the bad boys, attacking the old world order and every other form of order and decency. So how is it that Mick Jagger got knighted by Prince Charles in 2002 for service to the Empire and Crown? Exactly what service did he ever do them? Given the mainstream interpretation of the Stones, it makes no sense. But given my interpretation, it makes all the sense in the world. Jagger and the Stones manufactured and promoted accelerated change of all kinds, which financially benefited the Empire and Crown enormously. Given that the Stones, and the Beatles, too, after 1967, were sold as wildly anti-establishment, ya would expect the royals and the British/US governments to be against them all the way. And yet we find the secret services in both countries promoting them with every trick available. In my paper on Lenin, we saw the BSC, the US arm of British intelligence, promoting these bands as part of the mobilization of pro-British opinion. Given what we have been taught, that makes no sense. But given Operation Rolling Stone, it makes complete sense. Both governments wanted accelerated change in societal dissolution, because both governments were being run by the financiers. Change and dissolution have proved to be engines of stratospheric levels of profit for these very few families.